Hello and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. I will also post the links to it at our daily KirksvilleToday.com where we do a white world wrap and at our social microblog pieville.net. Today we're going to resume with Saki, the complete stories by Hector Human Roe. And we'll do, as usual, four. We'll begin with The Lull. The Lull. L-U-L-L. I've asked Latimer Springfield to spend Sunday with us and stop the night, announced Mrs. Dermott at the breakfast table. I thought he was in the throes of an election, remarked her husband. Exactly. The poll is on Wednesday, and the poor man will have worked himself to a shadow by that time. Imagine what electioneering must be like in this awful soaking rain, going along slushy country roads and speaking to damp audiences in drafty schoolrooms day after day for a fortnight. He'll have to put in an appearance at some place of worship on Sunday morning, and he can come to us immediately afterwards and have a thorough respite from everything connected with politics. I won't even let him think of them. I've had the picture of Cromwell dissolving the Long Parliament taken down from the staircase, and even the portrait of Lord Rosebery's Ladas, L-A-D-A-S, removed from the smoking room. And, Vera, added Mrs. Dermott, turning to her 16-year-old niece, be careful what color ribbon you wear in your hair, not blue or yellow on any account. Those are the rival party colors, I think Labour and Tories. An emerald green or orange would be almost as bad with this home rule business to the fore. That's the Irish stuff. On state occasions, I always wear a black ribbon in my hair, said Vera with crushing dignity. Latimer Springfield was a rather cheerless, oldish young man who went into politics somewhat in the spirit in which other people might go into half mourning. Without being an enthusiast, however, he was a fairly strenuous plotter, and Mrs. Dermott had been reasonably near the mark in asserting that he was working at high pressure over this election. The restful lull in which his hostess enforced on him was decidedly welcome, and yet the nervous excitement of the contest had too great a hold on him to be totally banished. I know he's going to sit up half the night working up points for his final speeches, said Mrs. Dermott regretfully. However, we've kept politics at arm's length all the afternoon and evening. More than that, we cannot do. That remains to be seen, said Vera, but she said it to herself, and remember we had her in another story talking about the ghostly hunters who were going to return that drove the guest away. At least, I think that's what she did. Or I think that was her, I'm not sure. It was certainly a girl named Vera. So she's saying maybe we can do a little more, but Latimer had scarcely shut his bedroom door before he was immersed in a sheaf of notes and pamphlets, while a fountain pen and pocketbook were brought into play for the due marshalling of useful facts and discreet fictions. He had been at work for perhaps 35 minutes, and the house was seemingly consecrated to the healthy slumber of country life when a stifled squealing and scuffling in the passage was followed by a loud tap at his door. Before he had time to answer, a much encumbered Vera burst into the room with a question, I say, can I leave these here? These were a small black pig and a lusty specimen of black-red gamecock. Latimer was moderately fond of animals and particularly interested in small livestock rearing from the economic point of view. In fact, one of the pamphlets on which he was at that moment engaged warmly advocated the further development of the pig and poultry industry in our rural districts, but he was pardonably unwilling to share even a commodious bedroom with samples of hen roost and sty products. Wouldn't they be happier somewhere outside? He asked, tactfully expressing his own preference in the matter in an apparent solicitude for theirs, a very, very, very common technique. There is no outside, said Vera impressively, nothing but a waste of dark, swirling waters. The reservoir at Brinkley has burst. I didn't know there was a reservoir at Brinkley, said Latimer. Well, there isn't now, and it's jolly well all over the place. And as we stand particularly low, we're at the center of an inland sea just at present. You see, the river has overflowed its banks as well. Good gracious, have any lives been lost? Heaps, I should say. The second housemaid has already identified three bodies that have floated past the billiard room window as being the young man she's engaged to. Either she's engaged to a large assortment of the population round here, or else she's very careless at identification. Of course, it may be the same body coming round and round again in a swirl. I hadn't thought of that. But we ought to go out and do rescue work, oughtn't we? Said Latimer, with the instinct of a parliamentary candidate for getting into the local limelight. We can't, said Vera decidedly. We haven't any boats, and we're cut off by a raging torrent from any human habitation. Remember, she's the one with a gift for romance. Meaning making a color, adding like a color commentator in a sporting game or something. She's inventing things out of her imagination. My aunt particularly hoped you would keep to your room and not add to the confusion, but she thought it would be so kind of you if you would take in Hartlepool's Wonder, the gamecock, you know, for the night. You see, there are 8 other gamecocks, and they fight like furies if they get together, so we're putting one in each bedroom. The fowl houses are all flooded out now, you know. And then I thought perhaps you wouldn't mind taking in this wee piggy. He's rather a little love, but he has a vile temper. He gets that from his mother. Not that I like to say things against her when she's lying dead and drowned in her sty, poor thing. What he really wants is a man's firm hand to keep him in order. I'd try and grapple with him myself, only I've got my chow in my room, you know, and he goes for pigs wherever he finds them. Couldn't the pig go in the bathroom? Asked Latimer, faintly, wishing that he had taken up as determined a stand on the subject of bedroom swine as the chow had. The bathroom, Vera laughed shrilly, is full of Boy Scouts till morning if the hot water holds out. Boy Scouts? Yes, 30 of them came to rescue us while the water was only waist high. Then it rose another 3 feet or so, and we had to rescue them. We're giving them hot baths in batches and drying their clothes in the hot air cupboard, but, of course, drenched clothes don't dry in a minute, and the corridor and the staircase are beginning to look like a bit of coast scenery by Tuke. Two of the boys are wearing your Melton overcoat. I hope you don't mind. It's a new overcoat, said Latimer, with every indication of minding dreadfully. You'll take every care of Hartlepool's Wonder, won't you? Said Vera. His mother took 3 firsts at Birmingham, and he was second in the cockerel class last year at Gloucester. He'll probably roost on the rail at the bottom of your bed. I wonder if he'd feel more at home if some of his wives were up here with him. The hens are all in the pantry, and I think I could pick out Hartlepool Helen. She's his favorite. Latimer showed a belated firmness on the subject of Hartlepool Helen, and Vera withdrew without pressing the point, having first settled the gamecock on his extemporized perch. Notice that use. Extemporized. You usually think of that in relation to speech, but here she just an impromptu or sort of immediate arrangement. Interesting use of it. And that's one of the main things you learn in literature if you're a writer or you're merely interested in such things is different uses of words, common or uncommon, that you just don't see every day, and you appreciate the sense when you read it, used by a master, as Saki certainly is. And taking an affectionate farewell of the pigling, Latimer undressed and got into bed with all due speed, judging that the pig would abate its inquisitional restlessness once the light was turned out. As a substitute for a cozy straw-bedded sty, the room offered, at first inspection, few attractions, but the disconsolate animal suddenly discovered an appliance in which the most luxuriously contrived piggies were notably deficient. The sharp edge of the underneath part of the bed was pitched at exactly the right elevation to permit the pigling to scrape himself ecstatically backwards and forwards with an artistic humping of the back at the crucial moment and an accompanying gurgle of long-drawn delight. The gamecock, who may have fancied that he was being rocked in the branches of a pine tree, bore the motion with greater fortitude than Latimer was able to command. A series of slaps directed at the pig's body were accepted more as an additional and pleasing irritant than as a criticism of conduct or a hint to desist. Evidently, something more than a man's firm hand was needed to deal with the case. Latimer slipped out of bed in search of a weapon of dissuasion. There was sufficient light in the room to enable the pig to detect this maneuver, and the vile temper, inherited from the drowned mother, found full play. Latimer bounded back into bed, and his conqueror, after a few threatening snorts and champings of its jaws, resumed its massage operations with renewed zeal. Notice champing at the bit. A lot of people will write chomping because they're illiterate and they don't read. Champing, C-H-A-M-A-M-P, champing at the bit. Here used in the bit is the leather in the mouth of the horse. Here it's just a pig champing its jaws. During the long wakeful hours which ensued, Latimer tried to distract his mind from his own immediate troubles by dwelling with decent sympathy on the second housemaid's bereavement, the loss of her fiancé. But he found himself more often wondering how many Boy Scouts were sharing his Melton overcoat. The role of Saint Martin, malgré lui, was not one which appealed to him. Now I'm going to look up malgré lui because I forgot what it means. So malgré lui means in spite of himself. It was actually used in a play by French farce by, let's see, trying to Le Médecin malgré lui. The doctor physician in spite of himself is a farce by Molière. Yes, okay. It's funny, I don't remember that. Anyway, towards dawn, the pigling fell into a happy slumber, and Latimer might have followed its example, but at about the same time, stupor Hartpooley gave a rousing crow, clattered down to the floor, and forthwith commenced a spirited combat with his reflection in the wardrobe mirror. Remembering that the bird was more or less under his care, Latimer performed Hague tribunal offices by draping a bath towel over the provocative mirror, but the ensuing peace was local and short-lived. The deflected energies of the gamecock found new outlet in a sudden and sustained attack on the sleeping and temporarily inoffensive pigling, and the duel which followed was desperate and embittered beyond any possibility of effective intervention. The feathered combatant had the advantage of being able, when hard-pressed, to take refuge on the bed, and freely availed himself of this circumstance. The pigling never quite succeeded in hurling himself onto the same eminence, but it was not from want of trying. Neither side could claim any decisive success, and the struggle had been practically fought to a standstill by the time that the maid appeared with the early morning tea. "No, sir," she explained in undisguised astonishment. "Do you want those animals in your room?" "Want?" The pigling, as though aware that it might have outstayed its welcome, dashed out at the door, and the gamecock followed it at a more dignified pace. "If Miss Vera's dog sees that pig," exclaimed the maid, and hurried off to avert such a catastrophe. A cold suspicion was stealing over Latimer's mind. He went to the window and drew up the blind. A light, drizzling rain was falling, but there was not the faintest trace of any inundation. Some half hour later, he met Vera on the way to the breakfast room. "I should not like to think of you as a deliberate liar," he observed coldly, "but one occasionally has to do things one does not like." "At any rate, I kept your mind from dwelling on politics all night," said Vera, which was, of course, perfectly true. "I should not like to think of you as a deliberate liar, but occasionally one has to do things one does not like." Next story is the unkindest blow. The season of strikes seemed to have run itself to a standstill. Almost every trade and industry and calling in which a dislocation could possibly be engineered had indulged in that luxury of a strike. The last and least successful convulsion had been the strike of the World's Union of Zoological Garden Attendants, who, pending the settlement of certain demands, refused to minister further to the wants of the animals committed to their charge, or to allow any other keepers to take their place. In this case, the threat of the zoological gardens authorities that if the men came out, the animals should come out also had intensified and precipitated the crisis. This imminent prospect of the larger carnivores, to say nothing of rhinoceroses and bull bison, roaming at large and unfed in the heart of London, was not one which permitted of prolonged conferences. The government of the day, which from its tendency to be a few hours behind the course of events had been nicknamed the government of the afternoon, was obliged to intervene with promptitude and decision. A strong force of bluejackets was dispatched to Regent's Park to take over the temporarily abandoned duties of the strikers. Bluejackets were chosen in preference to land forces, partly on account of the traditional readiness of the British Navy to go anywhere and do anything, partly by reason of the familiarity of the average sailor with monkeys, parrots, and other tropical fauna, but chiefly at the urgent request of the First Lord of the Admiralty, who was keenly desirous of an opportunity for performing some personal act of unobtrusive public service within the province of his department. If he insists on feeding the infant jaguar himself, in defiance of its mother's wishes, there may be another by-election in the north, said one of his colleagues, with a hopeful inflection in his voice. By-elections are not very desirable at the present, but we must not be selfish. As a matter of fact, the strike collapsed peacefully without any outside intervention. The majority of the keepers had become so attached to their charges that they returned to work of their own accord. And then the nation and the newspapers turned with a sense of relief to happier things. It seemed as if a new era of contentment was about to dawn. Everybody had struck who could possibly want to strike, or could possibly be cajoled or bullied into striking, whether they wanted to or not. The lighter and brighter side of life might now claim some attention. And conspicuous among the other topics that sprang into sudden prominence was the pending Falvertoon divorce suit. The Duke of Falvertoon was one of those humans, hors d'oeuvres, that stimulate the public appetite for sensation without giving it much to feed on. As a mere child, he had been precociously brilliant. He had declined the editorship of the Anglian Review at an age when, so he even transfers fake magazine titles across stories. So it's a world he's creating. These are little slices of it. As a mere child, he had been precociously brilliant. He had declined the editorship of the Anglian Review at an age when most boys are content to have declined Mensa, a table, and though he could not claim to have originated the futurist movement in literature, his Letters to a Possible Grandson, written at the age of 14, had attracted considerable notice. In later days, his brilliancy had been less conspicuously displayed. During a debate in the House of Lords on affairs in Morocco, at a moment when that country, for the fifth time in 7 years, had brought half Europe to the verge of war, he had interpolated the remarks, "a little more and how much it is," but in spite, so that's a witty line, "a little more, M-O-O-R, and how much it is," but in spite of the encouraging reception accorded to this one political utterance, he was never tempted to further display in that direction. It began to be generally understood that he did not intend to supplement his numerous town and country residences by living overmuch in the public eye. And then had come the unlooked-for tidings of the imminent proceedings for divorce. And such a divorce. There were cross-suits and allegations and counter-allegations, charges of cruelty and desertion, everything, in fact, that was necessary to make the case one of the most complicated and sensational of its kind. And the number of distinguished people involved or cited as witnesses not only embraced both political parties in the realm and several colonial governors, but included an exotic contingent from France, Hungary, the United States of North America, and the Grand Duchy of Baden. Hotel accommodation of the more expensive sort began to experience a strain in its resources. "It will be quite like the Durbar without the elephants," remarked an enthusiastic lady who, to do her justice, had never seen a Durbar. The general feeling was one of thankfulness that the last of the strikes had been got over before the date fixed for the hearings of the great suit. As a reaction from the season of gloom and industrial strife that had just passed away, the agencies that purvey and stage-manage sensations laid themselves out to do their level best on this momentous occasion. Men who had made their reputations as special descriptive writers were mobilized from distant corners of Europe and the further side of the Atlantic, In order to enrich with their pens the daily printed records of the case, one word painter who specialized in descriptions of how witnesses turned pale under cross-examination was summoned hurriedly back from a famous and prolonged murder trial in Sicily, where indeed his talents were being decidedly wasted. Thumbnail artists and expert Kodak manipulators were retained at extravagant salaries, and special dress reporters were in high demand. An enterprising Paris firm of costume builders presented the defendant Duchess with three special creations to be worn, marked, learned, and extensively reported at various critical stages of the trial. And as for the cinematograph agents, their industry and persistence was untiring. Films representing the Duke saying goodbye to his favorite canary on the eve of the trial were in readiness weeks before the event was due to take place. Other films depicted the Duchess holding imaginary consultations with fictitious lawyers or making a light repast off specially advertised vegetarian sandwiches during a supposed luncheon interval. As far as human foresight and human enterprise could go, nothing was lacking to make the trial a success. 2 days before the case was down for hearing, the advance reporter of an important syndicate obtained an interview with the Duke for the purpose of gleaning some final grains of information concerning His Grace's personal arrangements during the trial. "I suppose I may say this will be one of the biggest affairs of its kind during the lifetime of a generation," began the reporter as an excuse for the unsparing minuteness of detail that he was about to make quest for. "I suppose so, if it comes off," said the Duke lazily. "If?" queried the reporter in a voice that was something between a gasp and a scream. "The Duchess and I are both thinking of going on strike," said the Duke. "Strike?" The baleful word flashed out in all its old hideous familiarity. Was there to be no end to its recurrence? "Do you mean," faltered the reporter, "that you are contemplating a mutual withdrawal of the charges?" "Precisely," said the Duke. "But think of the arrangements that have been made. The special reporting, the cinematographs, the catering for the distinguished foreign witnesses, the prepared music hall allusions. Think of all the money that has been sunk." "Exactly," said the Duke coldly. "The Duchess and I have realized that it is we who provide the material out of which this great and far-reaching industry has been built up. Widespread employment will be given, and enormous profits made during the duration of the case, and we, on whom all the stress and racket falls, will get what? An unenviable notoriety and the privilege of paying heavy legal expenses, whichever way the verdict goes. Hence our decision to strike. We don't wish to be reconciled. We fully realize that it is a grave step to take, but unless we get some reasonable consideration out of this vast stream of wealth and industry that we have called into being, we intend on coming out of court and staying out. Good afternoon." Well, this sounds awfully darn modern, doesn't it? The news of this latest strike spread universal dismay. Its inaccessibility to the ordinary methods of persuasion made it peculiarly formidable. If the Duke and Duchess persisted in being reconciled, the government could hardly be called on to interfere. Public opinion in the shape of social ostracism might be brought to bear on them, but that was as far as coercive measures could go. There was nothing for it but a conference with powers to propose liberal terms. As it was, several of the foreign witnesses had already departed, and others had telegraphed canceling their hotel arrangements. The conference, protracted, uncomfortable, and occasionally acrimonious, succeeded at last in arranging for a resumption of litigation, but it was a fruitless victory. The Duke, with a touch of his earlier precocity, died of premature decay a fortnight before the date fixed for the new trial. Very modern sounding, to my ear at least. The next story is called The Romancers. The Romancers. Truly, all his stories are about the same length. It was autumn in London, that blessed season between the harshness of winter and the insincerities of summer. A trustful season when one buys bulbs and sees to the registration of one's vote, believing perpetually in spring and a change of government. Morton Crosby sat on a bench in a secluded corner of Hyde Park, lazily enjoying a cigarette and watching the slow, grazing promenade of a pair of snow geese, the male looking rather like an albino edition of the russet-hued female. Out of the corner of his eye, Crosby also noted with some interest the hesitating hoverings of a human figure, which had passed and repassed his seat two or three times at shortening intervals, like a wary crow about to alight near some possibly edible morsel. Inevitably, the figure came to an anchorage on the bench within easy talking distance of its original occupant. The uncared-for clothes, the aggressive, grizzled beard. Grizzled basically means gray. I'd never put that together, but, you know, there's black bears, there's brown bears, there's white bears called polar bears. There's Kodiak bears, but there's also grizzly bears. But what does grizzly mean? It actually means gray, like a gray old beard usually. So grizzly bear is like a gray bear. The uncared-for clothes, the aggressive, grizzled beard, and the furtive, evasive eye of the newcomer bespoke the professional cadger, the mall who would undergo hours of humiliating tail-spinning and rebuff rather than adventure on half a day's decent work. For a while, the newcomer fixed his eye straight out in front of him in a strenuous, unseeing gaze. Then his voice broke out with the insinuating inflection of one who has a story to retail well worth any loiterer's while to listen to. "It's a strange world," he said. As the statement met with no response, he altered it to the form of a question. "I dare say you found it to be a strange world, mister." "As far as I'm concerned," said Crosby, "the strangeness has worn off in the course of 36 years. "Ah," said the graybeard, "I could tell you things that you'd hardly believe. Marvelous things that have really happened to me." "Nowadays, there is not demand for marvelous things that have really happened," said Crosby discouragingly. "The professional writers of fiction turn out these things so much better. For instance, my neighbors tell me wonderful, incredible things that their Aberdeens and Chows and Borzois have done. I never listen to them. On the other hand, I have read The Hound of the Baskervilles 3 times. The graybeard moved uneasily in his seat. Then he opened up a new country. "I take it that you are a professing Christian," he observed. "I am a prominent, and I think I may say an influential member of the Muslim community of Eastern Persian," said Crosby, making an excursion himself into the realms of fiction. The graybeard was obviously disconcerted at this new check of introductory conversation, but the defeat was only momentary. "Persia. I should never have taken you for a Persian," he remarked, with a somewhat aggrieved air. "I am not," said Crosby. "My father was an Afghan." "An Afghan," said the other, smitten into bewildered silence for a moment. Then he recovered himself and renewed his attack. "Afghanistan. Ah, we've had some wars with that country now, I dare say. Instead of fighting it, we might have learned something from it. A very wealthy country, I believe. No real poverty there." He raised his voice on the word poverty with a suggestion of intense feeling. Crosby saw the opening and avoided it. "It possesses, nevertheless, a number of highly talented and ingenious beggars," he said. "If I had not spoken so disparagingly of marvelous things that have really happened, I would tell you the story of Ibrahim and the 11 camel loads of blotting paper. Also, I have forgotten exactly how it ended." "My own life story is a curious one," said the stranger, apparently stifling all desire to hear the story of Ibrahim. "Ibrahim, I was not always as you see me now." "We are supposed to undergo complete change in the course of every 7 years," said Crosby, as an explanation of the foregoing announcement. "I mean, I was not always in such distressing circumstances as I am at present," pursued the stranger doggedly. "That sounds rather rude," quiet, said Crosby stiffly, "considering that you are at present talking to a man reputed to be one of the most gifted conversationalists of the Afghan border." "I don't mean in that way," said the graybeard hastily. "I've been very much interested in your conversation. I was alluding to my unfortunate financial situation. You mayn't hardly believe it, but at the present moment I am absolutely without a farthing. Don't see any prospect of getting any money either for the next few days. I don't suppose you've ever found yourself in such a position," he added. "In the town of Yam," said Crosby, "which is in southern Afghanistan, and which also happens to be my birthplace, there was a Chinese philosopher who used to say that one of the three chiefest human blessings was to be absolutely without money. I forget what the other two were." Ah, I dare say, said the stranger in a tone that betrayed no enthusiasm for the philosopher's memory. And did he practice what he preached? That's the test. He lived happily with very little money or resources, said Crosby. Then I expect he had friends who would help him liberally whenever he was in difficulties, such as I am in present. In Yom, said Crosby, it is not necessary to have friends in order to obtain help. Any citizen of Yom, Y-O-M, would help a stranger as a matter of course. The graybeard was now genuinely interested. The conversation had at last taken a favorable turn. If someone like me, for instance, who was in an undeserved difficulties, asked a citizen of that town you speak of for a small loan to tide over a few days' impecuniosity, 5 shillings, or perhaps a rather larger sum, would it be given to him as a matter of course? There would be a certain preliminary, said Crosby. One would take him to a wine shop and treat him to a measure of wine, and then, after a little high-flown conversation, one would put the desired sum in his hand and wish him good day. It is a roundabout way of performing a simple transaction, but in the East, always a roundabout. The listener's eyes were glittering. Ah, he exclaimed, with a thin sneer ringing meaningly through his words, I suppose you've given up all those generous customs since you left your town. Don't practice them now, I expect. No one who has lived in Yom, said Crosby fervently, and remembers its green hills covered with apricot and almond trees, and the cold water that rushes down like a caress from the upland snow and dashes under the little wooden bridges, no one who remembers these things and treasures the memory of them would ever give up a single one of its unwritten laws and customs. To me, they are as binding as though I still lived in that hallowed home of my youth. And if I was to ask you for a small loan, began the graybeard fawningly, edging nearer on the seat and hurriedly wondering how large he might safely make his request, if I was to ask you for, say, at any other time, certainly, said Crosby. In the months of November and December, however, it is absolutely forbidden for anyone of our race to give or receive loans or gifts. In fact, one does not willingly speak of them. It is considered unlucky. We will therefore close this discussion. But it is still October, exclaimed the adventurer with an eager, angry whine as Crosby rose from his seat. Wants 8 days to the end of the month. The Afghan November began yesterday, said Crosby severely, and in another moment he was striding across the park, leaving his recent companion scowling and muttering furiously on his seat. I don't believe a word of his story, he chattered to himself, pack of nasty lies from beginning to end. Wish I'd told him so to his face, calling himself an Afghan. The snorts and snarls that escaped from him for the next quarter of an hour went far to support the truth of the old saying that two of a trade never agree. So I guess Crosby was a bum, too. Pretty good, though. And finally, the last story of this batch. He wrote more famous stories than I remember, because I remember this title, the Schartz-Metterklum method. The Schartz-Metterklum method. The Schartz, S-C-H-A-R-T-Z, Schartz-Metterklum method. Sounds vaguely German, doesn't it? Lady Carlotta. Lady Carlotta. Carlotta stepped out onto the platform of the small wayside station, and took a turn or two up and down its uninteresting length to kill time until the train should be pleased to proceed on its way. Then, in the roadway beyond, she saw a horse struggling with a more than ample load, and a carter of the sort that seems to bear a sullen hatred against the animal that helps him to earn a living. Lady Carlotta promptly betook her to the roadway and put rather a different complexion on the struggle. Certain of her acquaintances were wont to give her plentiful admonition as to the undesirability of interfering on behalf of a distressed animal, such interference being none of her business. Only once had she put the doctrine of non-interference into practice, when one of its most eloquent exponents had been besieged for nearly 3 hours in a small and extremely uncomfortable may tree by an angry boar pig, while Lady Carlotta, on the other side of the fence, had proceeded with the watercolor sketch she was engaged on and refused to intervene between the boar and his prisoner. It is to be feared that she lost the friendship of the ultimately rescued lady. On this occasion, she merely lost a train, which gave way to the first sign of impatience it had shown throughout the journey, and steamed off without her. She bore the desertion with philosophical indifference. Her friends and relations were thoroughly well used to the fact of her luggage arriving without her. She wired a vague, noncommittal message to her destination to say that she was coming on by another train. Before she had time to think what her next move might be, she was confronted by an imposingly attired lady who seemed to be taking a prolonged mental inventory of her clothes and looks. "You must be Miss Hope, the governess I've come to meet," said the apparition in a tone that admitted of very little argument. "Very well, if I must, I must," said Lady Carlotta to herself with dangerous meekness. "I am Mrs. Quabarl," continued the lady, "and where, pray, is your luggage?" Quabarl. "It's gone astray," said the alleged governess, falling in with the excellent rule of life that the absent are always to blame. The luggage had, in point of fact, behaved with perfect correctitude. "I've just telegraphed about it," she added, with a nearer approach to the truth. "How provoking," said Mrs. Quabarl. "These railway companies are so careless. However, my maid can lend you things for the night," and she led her way to her car. During the drive to the Quabarl mansion, Lady Carlotta was impressively introduced to the nature of the charge that had been thrust upon her. She learned that Claude and Wilfried were delicate, sensitive young people, and that Irene had the artistic temperament highly developed, and that Viola was something of the something or other else of a mold equally commonplace among children of that class and type in the 20th century. "I wish them not only to be taught," said Mrs. Quabarl, "but interested in what they learn. In their history lessons, for instance, you must try to make them feel that they are being introduced to the life stories of men and women who really lived, not merely committing a mass of names and dates to memory. French, of course. I shall expect you to talk at mealtime several days in the week." "I shall talk French 4 days of the week and Russian in the remaining three." "Russian, my dear Miss Hope. No one in the house speaks or understands Russian." "That will not embarrass me in the least," said Lady Carlotta coldly. Mrs. Quabarl, to use a colloquial expression, was knocked off her perch. She was one of those imperfectly self-assured individuals who are magnificent and autocratic as long as they are not seriously opposed. The least show of unexpected resistance goes a long way towards rendering them cowed and apologetic. When the new governess failed to express wondering admiration of the large, newly purchased and expensive car and lightly alluded to the superior advantages of one or two makes which had just been put on the market, the discomfiture of her patroness became almost abject. Her feelings were those which might have animated a general of ancient warfaring days on beholding his heaviest battle elephant ignominiously driven off the field by slingers and javelin throwers. At dinner that evening, although reinforced by her husband, who usually duplicated her opinions and lent her moral support generally, Mrs. Quabarl regained none of her lost ground. The governess not only helped herself well and truly to wine, but held forth with considerable show of critical knowledge on various vintage matters, concerning which the Quabarls were in no wise able to pose as authorities. Previous governesses had limited their conversation on the wine topic to a respectful and doubtless sincere expression of a preference for water. When this one went as far as to recommend a wine firm in whose hands you could not go very far wrong, Mrs. Quabarl thought it time to turn the conversation into more usual channels. "We got very satisfactory references about you from Canon Teep," she observed. "A very estimable man, I should think. Drinks like a fish and beats his wife. Otherwise, a very lovable character," said the governess imperturbably. "My dear Miss Hope, I trust you are exaggerating," exclaimed the Quabarls in unison. "One must admit in justice that there is some provocation," continued the romancer. And romancer is the term he's making up, using for made-up stories, as we've seen in multiple of these. "Mrs. Teep is quite the most irritating bridge player that I have ever sat down with. Her leads and declarations would condone a certain amount of brutality in her partner, but to souse her with the contents of the only soda water siphon in the house on a Sunday afternoon, when one couldn't get another, argues an indifference to the comfort of others which I cannot altogether overlook. You may think me hasty in my judgments, but it was practically on account of the siphon incident that I left." "We will talk of this some other time," said Mrs. Quabarl hastily. "I shall never allude to it again," said the governess with decision. Mr. Quabarl made a welcome diversion by asking what studies the new instructress proposed to inaugurate on the morrow. "History, to begin with," she informed him. "Ah, history," he observed sagely. "Now, in teaching them history, you must take care to interest them in what they learn. You must make them feel that they are being introduced to the life stories of men and women who really lived." "I've told her all that," interposed Mrs. Quabarl. "I teach history on the Schartz-Metterklume method," said the governess loftily. "Ah, yes," said her listeners, thinking it expedient to assume an acquaintance at least with the name. Again, you see how the seeming and the appearance and the posing are huge elements in upper-class English life. "What are you children doing out here?" demanded Mrs. Quabarl the next morning, on finding Irene sitting rather glumly at the head of the stairs, while her sister was perched in an attitude of depressed discomfort on the window seat behind her, with a wolfskin rug almost covering her up. "We are having a history lesson," came the unexpected reply. "I am supposed to be Rome, and Viola up there is the she-wolf, not a real wolf, but the figure of one that Romans used to set store by, I forget why. Claude and Wilfred have gone to fetch the shabby women." "The shabby women?" "Yes, they've got to carry them off. They didn't want to, but Miss Hope got one of Father's five spats. I guess that's a cricket bat, and said she'd give them a number 9 spanking if they didn't, so they've gone to do it." A loud, angry screaming from the direction of the lawn drew Mrs. Quabarl thither in hot haste, fearful lest the threatened castigation might even now be in the process of infliction. The outcry, however, came principally from the two small daughters of the lodge-keeper, who were being hauled and pushed towards the house by the panting and disheveled Claude and Wilfred, whose task was rendered even more arduous by the incessant, if not very effectual, attacks of the captured maiden's small brother. The governess, bat in hand, sat negligently on the stone balustrade, presiding over the scene with the cold impartiality of a goddess of battles. A furious and repeated chorus of "I'll tell mother" rose from the lodge children, but the lodge mother, who was hard of hearing, was for the moment immersed in the preoccupation of her washtub. After an apprehensive glance in the direction of the lodge, the good woman was gifted with the highly militant temper which is sometimes the privilege of deafness. Mrs. Quabarl flew indignantly to the rescue of the struggling captives. "Wilfred, Claude, let those children go at once. Miss Hope, what on earth is the meaning of this scene?" "Early Roman history. The Sabine women, don't you know? The Rape of the Sabines, a famous painting. I forget who painted it, but yeah, they're carrying off the Sabine women. It's the Schartz-Metterklume method to make children understand history by acting it out themselves. Fixes it in their memory, you know. Of course, if thanks to your interference, your boys go through life thinking that the Sabine women ultimately escaped, I really cannot be held responsible." "You may be very modern and clever, Miss Hope," said Mrs. Quabarl firmly, "but I should like you to leave here by the next train. Your luggage will be sent for you as soon as it arrives." "I'm not certain exactly where I shall be for the next few days," said the dismissed instructress of youth. "You might keep my luggage till I wire my address. There are only a couple of trunks and some golf clubs and a leopard cub." "A leopard cub?" gasped Mrs. Quabarl. Even in her departure, this extraordinary person seemed destined to leave a trail of embarrassment behind her. "Well, it's rather left off being a cub. It's more than half grown, you know. A fowl every day and a rabbit on Sundays is usually what it gets. Raw beef makes it too excitable. Don't trouble about getting the car for me. I'm rather inclined for a walk." And Lady Carlotta strode out of the Quabarl horizon. The advent of the genuine Miss Hope, who had made a mistake as to the day on which she was due to arrive, caused a turmoil which that good lady was quite unused to inspiring. Obviously, the Quabarl family had been woefully befooled, but a certain amount of relief came with the knowledge. "How tiresome for you, dear Carlotta," said her hostess when the overdue guest ultimately arrived. "How very tiresome losing your train and having to stop overnight in a strange place." "Oh, dear, no," said Lady Carlotta, "not at all tiresome. For me." And that concludes the Schartz-Metterklume method, the final story of today's batch of four, as usual. So I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of Hector Human Rose, The Complete Stories of Saki, which you can find posted at vnnforum.com in the massive audiobooks section. Links to it posted elsewhere. Thank you for being with me today, and I will be back with you again for more Saki real soon.